Hi, I'm Stephen Usry, and this is a special podcast for Chapter16.org, the literature website of Humanities Tennessee, which is an independent affiliate of the National Endowment of the Humanities. I recently had the opportunity to sit down for about an hour with George Saunders and talk about his new short story collection, 10th of December. Critical acclaim came immediately to George Saunders in 1996 with the publication of his first collection of short stories, Civil War Land and Bad Decline. The success allowed him to leave his first career in geology and technical writing and join the faculty at Syracuse University. His experience of crafting a precise and highly managed point of view for corporations informs his fiction with brand name awareness, empty speak, and the never quite fulfilled promises of better living through chemistry. These concepts, plus the occasional theme park, serve as the basis of many of Saunders' stories, which are then skewed with just hints of science fiction weirdness. This take on the American condition has earned him 4 National Magazine Awards, as well as MacArthur and Guggenheim Fellowships. His first collection of stories since 2006's In Persuasion Nation, 10th of December retains his savage wit, but it also shows him at his most compassionate. High expectations for the new book have yielded to near-universal critical approval, led by the New York Times declaring it the best book you'll read this year. And now, my conversation with George Saunders. Victory Lap, the first story in the 10th of December, takes the internal voices of 3 characters. Allison Pope, a soon-to-be 15-year-old, Kyle Boot, her neighbor and classmate, and a kidnapper whose name I can't remember if it was even mentioned in the story. And the thing that impressed me the most about the story itself is that the sense you get is that you're seeing how different parenting styles affected them all.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't really the intention, except sort of mid-stride you note that that's happening a little bit. And so for me, that story started as I was kind of feeling like I'd like to get over my addiction to violence in stories and to sort of drama, making things dramatic by violence. So I was studying this Chekhov story called After the Opera, which is just a sweet little 5-page thing. A young woman goes to her first big social event and comes home and kind of just thinks, you know, about the different boys, and just a beautiful little sketch. So I thought, well, let me try that. So I did it, and I got to the end, and I just wasn't enough. It wasn't whatever was made that Chekhov version of story wasn't present in mind. So then, of course, I kicked in a little violence. So the theme and all that stuff kind of came, you know, for me, it always comes in from the side. If you concentrate on making a voice and making it kind of funny and fast and a certain model of escalation that I'm kind of aware of in my gut. So if I concentrate on that, suddenly these other things, like the parenting thing that you mentioned, starts to come in. And maybe halfway through the story, you note it. And you just sort of try not to get too clingy about it. But you go, okay, so parents are a thing. And then when you go to do the next bit, that's sort of there, you know, just sort of hanging over the story. So for me, the whole process is kind of trying to keep the conscious mind a little bit at bay without totally disrespecting it and kind of just stay in the sort of creative energy of the sentence generation with the trust that all the other stuff that we want from literature, you know, character and theme will come in of its own accord in a kind of natural way, you know.
So when you have that realization, does that realization feel the same every time in every story?
No. And oftentimes it's just like if you had talked to me the day I finished that story, I was kind of dimly aware that there were parents in the story. But I would have probably said that the parents were there almost as an after-the-fact explanation of why the kids were talking and thinking the way they were. So, for example, Kyle is kind of overmanaged.
Kind of.
Well, depending on your parenting style. But I didn't know that but if you look at his speech patterns, it's clear that he's always responding to this internalized father. That was just a comic riff. But then after the 9 millionth revision, you go, wow, that guy is really responding to his internal father. So the father has to be a guy in the story. And then, you know, dimly you go, oh, yeah, and actually there's a parallelism with the two parents going on. But my thing is, when I first started writing, I'd been an engineer, came to writing kind of late. And so I had that kind of intimidated respect for the thematic, you know, that I thought maybe you had to lay it all out in advance and execute it. Because I couldn't imagine how stories could be so complicated if someone hadn't planned it. So it was about a 7-year process of sort of disabusing myself of that notion. So now I'm really almost a little superstitious about thinking too thematically while I'm working. But it's almost like noting it at speed, but averting your eyes when you notice it, because whatever's going on thematically, it's going on pretty authentically from your subconscious, and you didn't start it and you can't stop it. So to note it, the only thing that might happen is if you get too conscious about it, you might kill the story by being right on the nose, you know, by delivering exactly what you've put in motion. So it's kind of a mysterious process.
Well, and it seems to echo in your fiction, because you do have some of these kind of more fantastical or alien elements mm-hmm. in the stories, and you never do an info dump and just let people know exactly what's going on. It's always just kind of a glance, cursory suggestion of something,
right.
and you keep going.
Yeah, and for me, that has to do with usually with trying to keep in mind who the narrator is. So in some of the stories where it's a first-person narrator, I try to think, well, you know, what would he actually, how would he actually think about this strange thing? So, for example, if we were writing a story about now, and I said, Kevin picked up the phone, which is a device for communicating with people far away, we don't think of it that way. So that would be an unnatural beat. So when I'm thinking of these sort of sci-fi universes, I try to think that the person is pretty naturalized, you know, that the strangeness is not actually all that strange to him. So then rhetorically, how does he talk about it? I actually took a lot of inspiration from a book called I Will Bear Witness by Victor Klemperer. It was a Holocaust diary by a guy who lived in Dresden. And that book is incredible because he doesn't know he's in the Holocaust. You know, he just thinks that he's running into some assholes every now and then, you know, and everything happens very glacially. And he never names it because he there's no name for it yet. So I thought that was a great model for sci-fi, actually, because in a sci-fi world, the inhabitants of the sci-fi world don't know they're in a sci-fi world. So that has a working principle. And also just as a kind of aesthetic principle, I think if I give you 70% of what you need to posit the fictive reality, you like me more. You know, I've credited your intelligence. You lean in a little bit. I give you 70%. You have a suspicion about what's going on. 3 pages later, I pat you on the hand and give you another 10%. And suddenly we're growing in intimacy, you know. And I think that's really an important part of the emotional effects that you eventually get in fiction, I think have to do with putting down those solid roots early so that when the character goes through something, the reader and the writer are right next to each other, kind of huddled with a mutual trust. And the thing that happens to all three, the character, the reader, and the writer at once. But I think to do that, you have to have kind of lured, seduced the person in to trust you, and also in this sort of logical framework, a plot twist or a kind of a sudden lurch is going to be more acceptable if you've bought everything up to that point 100%. I think this understatement is sort of a subtle part of that intimacy, you know.
But you almost address that awkwardness in the Simplica Girl diaries mm-hmm. because the guy keeping the diary is looking toward the future and trying to explain mundane things to the
right.
people in the
exactly.
future.
You know, there's this, what we understand as this horrible thing going on in his yard. But because he's acculturated to it, his eye doesn't. Just like in this Victor Klemperer book, I'm kind of making this up, but say there's a day when they take his office away because he's a Jew at the university. They push him out of his office. Well, the next beat in the diary is he's learning to drive and he knocks down the fence. And that gets a lot more lines than the office taking. You know, he thinks that will be fixed soon. The fence, on the other hand, is he's embarrassed about it. So I love that idea that whatever great evil we're participating in our generation, we don't know it. You know, we think we do, but we probably don't. Or, you know, slave narratives. So you read the diaries of slave owners. They're nice people, and they're not thinking, I'm evil or I'm doing this terrible thing. They're thinking about very mundane things. Well, the thing that we now recognize as the great issue of the day is taking place in the backyard.
So take a stab at it. What is the great issue of our day that we're ignoring?
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure, you know, probably global warming, I would imagine. Maybe I really don't know. I think it's probably something so innate to us that all of us good people don't notice it, you know. But also, actually, I would say to me that the thing that's happening that we're not noticing is a slide to what I would call materialism, which is first, it's the Charlie Brown Christmas special version where we're greedy and we're interested in things. But more importantly, it's the notion that the only actual knowledge is the knowledge that would come from the senses and logic. In other words, it just so happens in this view that the universe is exactly the same size as our capacity to understand it, which would be pretty weird if that was the case. But I think in my lifetime, there was a slide away from religion, say generally, or same difference, a slide towards a stupid kind of, you know, kind of reactionary religion with nothing substantial or profound to replace it. So you end up kind of buying into this idea that, well, whatever I sense naturally must be the truth. And that's a big step backwards in a lot of ways, and it's pretty dangerous. And so to me, I think that's probably what, in 100 years, if we're in a more enlightened state, we'll look back and go, wow, those guys really, they like their stuff, and they really believed in it. You know, and the other branch is that you end up being a slave to the kind of the triumphant victory narrative, like every person believes very strongly that their story is the main one, and that their ascension is kind of the most interesting thing in the world, and that, you know, at some level, dimly, that death will be defied if you can just win fast enough, you know. So, and at least when we were kids in Chicago, you know, there was Catholic mythology that address that. And maybe it was, you know, there was some molestation involved, but there was an attempt to sort of reckon that. And at least in a general way, I think that's moved away. And there hasn't been much to replace it, maybe something like that.
But isn't like a sense of ego, you know, essential to moving forward?
Sure. But a sense of ego, you know, and maybe a proper location of ego as a thing that's built. You know, we were born with it and we nurture it. And then ideally, you know, what happens in life is that gets kicked out of you a bit and you realize that, oh, contrary to what you thought, you're not at the center of the universe. You're not permanent. And your story isn't the only one. So I think that's maybe, to believe otherwise would be kind of a silly thing to do. But I think in a lot of ways there are forces on us that encourage that. And here I'm generalizing like a big dog, but maybe that encourage that more so than maybe 50 years ago. That's just a guess, I really, you know.
Do you think the use of the fantastical in your stories is a way to kind of like distance yourself from traditional tropes and kind of shake people a bit to say, you know, you should pay attention?
Well, it is. But really what it is it's an attempt to do that to myself, because I had a tendency when I was younger to just kind of be a strict realist, but without any real guns for that kind of writing. So I would write stuff that was pretty Hemingway-esque mostly, and it didn't get much energy going. Because I think as kind of a working class writer, I thought that art was something that you couldn't quite do. You know, like you may be able to do it 2 minutes a day or something if you were really lucky. And it had nothing to do with who you actually were as a person. It had to do with some lucky temporary construction of yourself that you could achieve. So for me to get out of that mode, I found if I put a funny, like early on, if I put a theme park in it or some ghost or something, then suddenly it disabled that Hemingway imitating. You couldn't do it with a straight face. And so in that rupture, then a lot of stuff that came naturally, like being a little funny, being a little nasty occasionally, or all the TV watching I'd done, that could come in more easily once you'd kind of ruptured that shell of sincerity and kind of earnestness. So it was just mechanical means to make sure that I don't get too full of it, basically, you know.
Well, and you talk about realism. Of course, anything is limited by a point of view, because no one can ever have an all-encompassing observation of everything. So how do you fight against limitation of your own point of view?
Well, one way is just to recognize that your point of view is actually made up of a lot of, you know, a thousand, a million different manifestations. And then kind of saying, let's pretend that there is no controlling narrative. So let's let in every one of those that you can convincingly manufacture. So in that victory lap story that you mentioned, to say, well, there's not really any true story. There's three different versions that are going on simultaneously. You know, if you were a really great writer, you could tell a story where there are six people in a room and you could perfectly hit the mind streams of all six. And then the result would be, you know, something like the truth. So, but from the writer's point of view, what you're really doing is you're just allowing to the table any manifestation of yourself that happens to show up. And not being too wed to the truth-telling aspect of it. It's just, if this voice comes out, that's okay, that's valid. This one, yeah, sure, come on in. So I kind of love the moment where you're seeing five or six, or maybe two or three contrasting views of something, and then having the authorial discipline to not weigh in too heavy on any of them. Just let them all resonate there equally together. And I think that's a really kind of wonderful effect if you can get it.
Do you find that you have that restraint in the drafting process, or does it have to come in editing?
I don't have it in the drafting process, but this always sounds dumb when you say it, but I find that if you revise enough, the text moves towards intelligence and it moves towards specificity, and it also weirdly moves towards fairness, only because the prose is better when those things get in. So for me, it's just a process of looking at a piece of prose, liking it all right, and then coming through and going, you know, that's a little bit false, or maybe it just sounds weird. That line sounds weird. Let's try to fix that. And go through it, you know, dozens, maybe hundreds of times, and slowly it starts to be smarter, more precise, kinder. And then also there's a kind of escalation that comes in, but not by design, but just by kind of exerting your choice iteratively hundreds of times. Mysteriously, the thing starts to get a little more like the person you'd like to be and a little bit less like the person you are. So it's kind of interesting. It's backwards from what I thought when I was young. I thought you had to be full of intentionality and know what you're going to do and then do it, and had no luck with that. And then when I reversed it and said, well, I'm just going to try to have fun line to line and try to improve it line to line, with improvement being defined on a sort of an ad hoc basis, then the thing starts doing all the things you wanted to do almost of its own accord, you know. So,
to throw a little BS science analogy in here, do you think that creative arts like writing and painting and even the creative art of living seems magical because it goes against the law of thermodynamic that wants entropy in the universe?
Well, now you're giving me a flashback to engineering school with that feeling of not knowing what the hell you're talking about. Well, here's the thing. The feeling that the world is chaotic is exactly equal to the mistake of having too small a concept, right? So if you think, well, the world is made of... Eventually, something's going to show up to contradict that, and you're going to feel like the world is chaotic. I certainly can't do this. But if you could exist in a state where you said, I really don't know what's going on, and I have almost no controlling concepts, then you would never feel confused or surprised because you're basically just saying, well, what is it? You know, what is the world? And so I had a great experience starting in 2006. I started doing a bunch of nonfiction travel pieces. And that was such a great reminder of that because, you know, you get some money for a piece and you know you're going to this place. And before you go, you sort of write the piece in your mind and you have an idea of what you want to say. Then you go there and for about a day, you cling to that idea and then it just gets knocked out of you. And you're in that state where you're just like, I'm not going to be able to write the story. I don't know what it's about. And then in that moment, then suddenly the data starts flooding in. Some idea rebuilds itself a little bit. But I think that's maybe one of the benefits of traveling and living is that, you know, you eventually see how shoddy your concepts are. And the idea to have them comes out of a kind of anxiety or, you know, a fear that if you don't have it, who are you, you know?
I think I heard an interview with Paul Theroux once, and he said that when he did his travel pieces that he made plans so that he knew they would break.
Exactly.
And
right.
That's where the interesting
thing
happened.
That's exactly, yeah, because the more rigidly you have the plan, the quicker you're convinced that you were all wrong. And actually, you know, if I could do it, I'd do one of those a year because no matter how much I say what I'm saying, the minute someone says, here's your assignment, here's some money, you know, all of your insecurities kick in. You know, oh my God, I got to figure this out before I go. And then when you go day by day, it'll all get torn away.
Well, how does that compare to traveling for pleasure when you have an agenda?
Probably about the same, I would imagine. Although in my experience is when I travel for pleasure, I'm more fanatic about sticking to the agenda. but I think with writing, you know, you have the benefit of you go on a trip and you're taking notes. And even as you're taking notes, you're starting to see that your original idea isn't. Like I lived in a homeless camp in Fresno for a week, kind of semi-incognito. And I think I had the idea that I would be this kind of beacon of kindness and, you know, maybe reform everybody in the camp and we would all, you know, they could all come stay at my house. So it was sort of like, well, this piece will be mostly about sympathy in the face of poverty, you know. And within the first 6 hours, I was so irritated and so scared and so ready and just like, this is so filthy. Why are you living here? And there was a lot of aggression, you know, and you could see that the only reason I wasn't getting victimized was because I was relatively sane and had nice glasses, you know, like there was some kind of like real subtle. So by the second day, that whole idea was gone. I couldn't even fake that I was going to be a beacon of sympathy. And it was kind of like, I just had to try not to bail. But then that was great because suddenly you go, oh, so if you're, you know, sort of posing the question of what should we do with these people who are living such miserable lives? Well, the first model, which was just be kind, that went out the door right away. Then you had to kind of reconfigure and say, okay, so I have to somehow have all those negative feelings and the fearful feelings and the angry feelings I'm having, along with at least clinging to the intellectual idea of trying to stay kind, trying to stay alive, you know. And so 6 days of that would clean out all of your stupid ideas, you know. Now, it might not leave you with any good ones, but at least the stupid ones have been kind of cleared out.
And going back to Victory Lap, the rapist you don't give a name to. Mm-hmm. You have names of people he's related to or interacted with, mm-hmm, in the past or his friends. Why not name him?
You know, actually, it's a practical reason, which was that in the other sections, you get the names in the first lines of introduction. And I think I maybe had a name for him at some point, but it was really a tricky narrative moment when he comes in because nobody wants him to come in. You don't really want to be in his head, and I didn't really want to be. So there's something about that transition to get it to work. The first word is maybe it's a, I don't remember if it's a swear word, but something pretty shocking. And so the transition is that, you know, Ed Filbert, the rapist, you know, that somehow took the energy down. So I think a lot of times you're doing things just to get from line 20 to line 21 without getting anyone to throw up, you know. So at that point, there was something about that transition that it wouldn't permit him to be. It wasn't a big intellectual decision, but it was just kind of at speed. You think, if I'm going to get them to buy this, I've got to get in there really quick. You're sort of utilizing the slight surprise that comes from having a close third person on this kind of monstrous guy.
But with Kyle, you had his father's voice and his mother's, mm-hmm, voice speaking to him. And there's the Melvin voice. We don't know if that's his father or his stepfather, right, or mom's boyfriend, or right, what, speaking to him. And, mm-hmm, that might have been an opportunity to just give a beat in there.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, one of the things I noticed, too, with that story, one of the tricky things was that voices, I think of it as third-person ventriloquist, where you have one or two lines of conventional third-person, and then as quickly as possible, you start using the diction of the character. So what I found in that story was I was trying to do a third-person section of the girl as she's being abducted. And I thought, I couldn't do it. And I thought, the reason you can't do it is because if you and I are both terrified, my guess is that our thought streams are pretty similar. You know, like I was in this near plane thing one time, and my thought stream was just, no. And so I'm guessing everybody on the plane, if you went into their heads, that's pretty much what they were. You couldn't distinguish any voice between anybody. So when she was scared, there really wasn't any, I couldn't get any purchase on how she talked or thought. Likewise with this guy, when we go into his head, he's in the middle of the action. He's not, as the other two characters are, they're kind of just lolling around their houses in the first two sections. But as soon as you see him, he's, you know, under stress. So there, I think, just kind of verisimilitude says you wouldn't want to give him too much thought time because he's in a different mode of action than they were. So.
Yeah, because almost all the action is observed by another person
in that
story.
Yeah, yeah.
And names in general, I'm not super well-read, but seeing the name Verlaine and Ferber, I mean, using writers' names as...
Totally just, for fun. I mean, I don't think I knew Ferber was a writer, actually.
Isn't it Ferber?
One thing I don't like is charging names with meaning somehow. Like if you have a guy and you call him Mr. Fussy, you know, or whatever. To me, it's just too easy. It's like an easy metaphorical effect that's somehow been used up. So if I could do it, my idea would be to have names that are totally not... But also, sometimes at speed, you know, you give a guy a name, Verlaine, and it's just his name. And it, sonically, you get a little addicted to it, and you kind of leave it in. So I would never encourage a reading of that kind because I just don't. If I saw it, I probably would change it if I, you know, was aware of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And throughout the book and the stories, there's quite a bit about the parent-child dynamic. Mm-hmm. I know everyone goes through it, but why does it interest you particularly enough to talk about it?
It's not conscious, really, but of course, our kids are 24 and 22 now. So during the time the book was written, they were in high school and then going to college. And I think maybe, I'm guessing at some level, you know, you get to the end of that phase of life and you're thinking about how you did. And like the Semco Girl Diaries, that was a 12-year deal. So that was all during their childhoods. And one of my goals is to try to not be trivial in the stories because they take a long time. So I'd like them to be sort of substantial. So that means you would ideally locate them somewhere near your actual heart issues, the thing that really matter. So for me, the biggest thing that ever happened to me was I got married and had a family. And that was the first, maybe the only time where I felt like I could really botch it, do something to myself that would ruin the rest of my life. So if I had somehow failed in that, you know, in providing for my kids, that would have been really something I couldn't shrug off. But at the same time, means were pretty tight for most of their childhood. So in a kind of funny way, what might seem banal was actually the most active moral thing in my life, which is we don't have enough money. We're getting to the point where we should have a little more money for them to hold their heads up in school. How do we get it? Also, at the same time, you're thinking, well, that seems pretty shallow. You know, couldn't we be poor and dignified? So all through their childhoods, that was a big thing. And that runs through the book, you know, the sense that material prosperity and grace shouldn't be connected, except they are. You know, we all know they are, unless you're superhuman. So that thing was in the book a lot, just because it was in my life, you know, a lot.
Well, especially in the Simplica.
Yeah, that one especially was a big one. You know, because we had this, my wife was smarter than me, and she said, what we should do is live like we're richer than we are, because the time when the kids were little is so short. Let's just try to simulate a richer lifestyle, and we'll figure it out afterwards. So we had our credit cards just jacked up. I mean, crazy, you know, crazy. So we're like, sometimes we'd get a check from the New Yorker, and it was just to sort of service the credit card debt, you know. And she just said, well, if we do the right things for them now, the worst that would happen is we would go bankrupt, but probably we won't. And so then we'll have that in the bag, and we can figure it out later. So that was kind of smart, but it's not without stress, you know. like in that story, there's a lot of moving, you know, you move money from checking to the Discover, and then discovered, you know, we did all that kind of stuff, and it was always a little stressful at the end of the month. But
so what does financial success feel like now?
We're not quite there. You know, we're so bad with money that we haven't quite felt it yet. But definitely, you know, like when that MacArthur came through, it just felt like a ceiling outlifted. And in kind of silly ways, like when I use a credit card, I have a little auto flinch. I just like kind of, I'm a little nicer to the person in the period between the time I give them the card and the time it, you know, it actually runs through, and have a little burst of relief once it runs through. And that went away for about a year, you know, just slightly. And so, but I mean, I kind of joke, but I think it's an interesting thing in fiction. A lot of the fiction I loved as a kid didn't really take into account material limitation. You know, Hemingway and I guess Fitzgerald kind of does in some of the stuff. But I kind of grew up thinking, well, a writer is a person who writes about stuff other than work. Paucity isn't really a thing. I wasn't reading the correct writers, and I hadn't read Tilly Olson, for example. But it seemed to me when I started writing that it was kind of interesting that you could spend your whole day making a living, trying to conserve money and stuff. And then when you wrote, you were supposed to pretend that that wasn't, you were fishing in Spain or something. And so it was kind of actually just a gift to kind of realize that that was not only valid, but it was, if that was a thing that was really concerning you, then it better get to the table.
Do you remember the first preconception you had about writing that you broke and felt good about breaking?
The very first one, I mean, I had a long period of just worshiping Hemingway. Then I think before I went to Syracuse, I'd written a series of kind of Hemingway-esque stories, Carver-esque stories. And then one night I had a dream, this really crazy dream about a theme parkish kind of a place. And then I just thought, and I started writing at night, which I wasn't doing. And I had two bottles of Boone's Farm and a pot of coffee. And I just wrote this crazy story that was a theme park story. And that was really, it felt really different. It also felt more lively than anything I'd done before. So I wrote that and I thought, wow, I don't know what that is, but I'll take it. So that was a big breakthrough. But then there was like a 9-year period where I kind of disavowed that and tried to go back to, actually earlier than that, I remember reading the Johnny Tremaine by Esther Forbes and just being struck by the fact that this woman that I didn't know had really made some radical choices in terms of language. The sentences weren't like spoken sentences and they were punctuated kind of strangely and they were kind of, so that was to kind of go around for a couple of days with thinking in that voice and trying to describe things that you saw. You could feel the mundane description of the thing, and then you could sort of feel the shadow description in her voice, and that was kind of an interesting thing.
Now, in Victory Lap, Kyle is referred to as beloved only, and the word beloved pops up a couple other times in the book. And since it was reinforced so much, I was sensitized to it. Mm-hmm. And so what does the concept of beloved mean to you?
I like that word a lot because it's hard to use. It's not one that you would fit into a sentence naturally. I don't know what it means, really. I mean, it's funny because I can remember times when I was looking for a word and hoping that one would come in. I think it's when we had our first daughter and then our second daughter, it kind of made the universe moral all of a sudden for me. I hadn't been like a bad person before, but I would do good things and not really know, I'd behave myself and wasn't sure exactly why. But then when we had our kids, I suddenly had that little blast, like a 24-hour blast of understanding that everybody had come into the world that way, and theoretically everybody had had somebody feel about them the way I felt about this new baby. And that seemed to be kind of energized everything, and it made stuff that before that didn't have a moral charge have a moral charge. So when I think of beloved, I think about that, that it fades, or maybe you're not lucky enough to have it, but that in some way your kind of birthright is to have somebody feel that you're precious, and that you're beloved. If you start from that place, then it really jangles everything up. It makes everything kind of magnetic. So then if you can take the next step and say, well, it doesn't really matter whether that's true of you or not, it should be true. And I think as a fictive thing, that's a pretty nice way to think that, some guy wanders into your story. In early drafts, he's just a punchline, or maybe he's just somebody who serves the food. But if you could sort of linger with the idea that he's beloved to somebody, then you are less inclined to let him do nothing or let him get no light in, So I think that it's a word I really love. I don't know any more than that.
Well, is there a moral effect that you expect from your fiction?
No. I think it's kind of dangerous to think about it too much like that. Okay, it's kind of a trope for writers to talk about the purpose of fiction, and there's all, breaks up the frozen pond within us and it makes us less lonely, and all those things are true, but I think functionally when you're working, my thing is I want to have the simplest model possible, because what if the story you're working on doesn't break up the frozen ice within you? Well, that's kind of hard to work with. But so for me, it's just to say I'm trying to do an energy transfer from me to you, and maybe go a little further and say the energy shouldn't be trivial. That's pretty good. And even to be a little less conceptual, to try to make a relationship that's not condescending line to line, that's a pretty good guidepost. Then I think stuff happens, but I'm not sure it's totally within your control. And I think my experience has been when you try to control it, when you try to know the effect you're going to have, you'll always reduce the effect. Your best bet is to kind of stay in close relation with the text and trust that if you're improving it, however you want to define that, then the effect will be improved. And eventually all the other stuff will happen. But as a functional thing, I find it better to not worry about that stuff too much. It's a form of propaganda, actually, to say that I know what I want my stories to do, when actually most of the time I think most writers kind of know. They can read a sentence to go, no, you don't. Now, why? Who cares? If a sentence is a little baggy and you trim it up, that's just a good, it's almost like if somebody throws a frisbee and you just catch it. Why did you do that? I don't know, it was a Frisbee, you know. So I think functionally, I get more work done if I don't worry about those big things and try to think about the line-to-line kind of progress. And
now for something completely ridiculous. In the title story, I believe it is, a raccoon has happened upon.
Mm-hmm.
And I was scanning back over Pastoralia mm-hmm. last night, and there was a raccoon.
Mm-hmm.
And so I called a friend that I knew had Impersuasive Nation, and I said, do a search on mm-hmm. your Kindle, and there's a raccoon in there, too. Yeah. So in at least your last three collections, a raccoon has popped
just
up.
Just like Hitchcock, you know, you put a... No, I think actually, you know, that a lot of the brain dump, there's just... This Kyle is a name I use a lot, you know. So I don't really... I kind of feel like if you produce it, mostly you trust it. So if I could have said, oh, a raccoon, that's too many raccoons, let's make it a rabbit. But for me, there's something kind of, if you sort of trust the subconscious, it's usually right, or the cost of not trusting it is too great. So I think maybe I kind of would go, yeah, oh, another raccoon. Oh, well, you know, whatever. Is it any different if it's a squirrel? Have I improved it or, you know, mm-hmm. so I don't know. Or maybe there's something hidden. I'm blocking some raccoon incident that happened in the past. That's a pretty funny word.
Well, the CK sound is inherently funny, they say.
Right.
Nickels are funnier than dimes.
Yeah, I think.
And something else that repeated, I was just scanning back over the book, and an exhortation, mm-hmm. it's kind of a memo from a supervisor to his workers. We learn about shelves, mm-hmm. and there's something kind of ominous
mm-hmm.
as shelves go on. And then in reading the Simplicity Girl's diary, we learn about shelves in there too. Is there any type of
what are the shelves?
The racks they
stand
on?
Yeah. No, I mean for me the rack and that the way I imagined it was sort of like a clothesline, like a V-shaped legs, and then that wire is like a metal wire that runs across through their heads. So it's not really it's called a rack, I think, but it's more of almost like a clothesline kind of thing. So they're not actually standing; they're sort of hanging. Their feet are about 3 feet off the ground. But no, I don't know. I mean, I think you're right, but I don't really notice that at speed so much. You know, that exhortation was part of a longer story that was in McSweeney's called Four Institutional Monologues, and it was meant to be kind of a look at genocide, like how does genocide look from different points of view, and what kind of language do we have to enact in order to? And I've been inspired by this memo that somebody sent me from that was a really incredible euphemistic thing about the items are prone to overreaction when exposure to light occurs. Therefore, it is helpful to minimize the occurrence of light whenever possible in order to expedite the process. And it was written by a guy in the SS, and he was talking about the boxcars, that if they opened the boxcars up in the day, it tended to make the Jews restless, you know. So I thought about that and how if you're a decent person in 1939 or 40, how do you do the things that they did? And I just got interested in the idea that you'd have to first have a linguistic floor to work on and that kind of passive voice. So those four pieces are kind of explorations of that kind of language.
Does your corporate writing past help you in making these contrived worlds?
Very much, because what I did was I was a tech writer for an environmental company, and it wasn't anything criminal, but we were always working for corporate clients who had problems, and whatever reports we put out would get into the newspaper. So if you said that cyanide in the water is probably bad for babies, that would be a storm. But if you said excessive levels of cyanide have been detected and may have deleterious health effects for those still early in life, or, you know, then you could kind of slide it under the door. So there was always a kind of a very subtle pressure to say things in ways that weren't causing alarm. Sometimes more overt things where we'd be called in to kind of put out certain fires. And actually towards the end of my tech writing career, I had this job of, there was a DOD facility that had a thorium leak of some kind. It was definitely in the groundwater. And actually it was manageable, but it's radioactivity in the groundwater. So they were trying to brainstorm ways to break the news. And they had broken the news, but the public was still concerned somehow about this radioactivity in the groundwater. They wanted some PR schemes that would make the public more friendly to them. So, for example, one company had a hazardous waste incinerator right in the middle of a residential neighborhood. And so to train the neighbors, they had an ice cream social literally inside the thing before they fired it up. So they had a band and balloons. And, you know, so my job was to go through all the literature of the last 20 years and find the sort of best PR schemes that this DOD facility could use. So it kind of made you really aware of the way that people talked when they weren't trying to lie, but they were just trying to soften the blow a little bit, which is, you know, in some ways almost worse.
Was it Bernays, the big PR, the writer of PR, is like Freud's nephew or something?
I'm not
like
sure, maybe, yeah. And this is pretty crude. It was just, you know, going, it was kind of pre-internet, and you just request these reports and kind of pile through them. But the other thing that happened was, you know, after you read enough of that stuff, you kind of get a feeling that there's a little poetry in it, you know, that if you say, okay, you have to tell me a really harsh truth, but you're not allowed to use direct speech, that can actually get kind of beautiful after a while. This idea that any kind of constricted diction that you use, if you push enough emotion through it, it actually becomes a little bit illuminated and kind of poetic. So that was a great way to start thinking about American speech, you know, that there's all kinds of places where the output valve is crimped, you know, but that doesn't mean that there's not real emotion coming through. And you can even define poetry as being true emotion through a crimped output. And then suddenly there's poetry everywhere, you know.
We'll talk about crimping an output. Mm. The concept and references to better living through chemistry pops up in the book several times.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on the dulling of human emotion through chemicals?
Well, actually, to be honest, I was getting tired of writing kind of minimally. I developed a certain habit of always taking my natural mode of speech and then taking it down just a few notches for comic effect. So I got to this story, Escape from Spiderhead, and I just really wanted to try to write in high literary diction. Somehow I kind of needed an excuse, so I did. I just did the transition. I went from like basic speech to high speech, and then I thought, well, I'd need a bridge. So I just kind of thought, well, it's, maybe he's on a drug, and plunked it in there. And then that created a whole like thematic thing, but it was mostly just kind of boredom, you know, with always writing in the same register. So.
And you got to do the high speech thing in My Chivalric Fiasco as well.
Yeah. That
was even which was higher. Chemically induced as well.
Right, yeah. Well, that fell off of the other story. It was part of the other story, and I couldn't use it, but I liked it. So I got set it aside and just kind of waited for it to make up its own story.
Which one of your drugs you've invented would you like for yourself?
I'd like that Verbalose that makes you more articulate. That would be useful. Yeah.
I think I would go with Chatty as myself.
Yeah, that's a good one. That makes it mean...
Just more ready to engage in conversation
right.
with
you
people.
You put the two of them together. And it's
wonderful. Then you might be Dick Cavett.
Right.
You talked about how the exhortation piece was part of a larger thing that had appeared before in McSweeney's. In putting a collection together, do you view it as a unit or is it a collection?
I think it's a unit. This one more than maybe anything else I've done. I had kind of put out all the things that I thought might go in there and cut out a few and then just put the first and last on index cards and just kind of played with it for a few days and moved it around. And in the end, it felt like it, you know, that was the right order. And that in addition to the idea is, you know, if you start it, you'll finish it. That's the hope. And then along the way, there was a lot of kind of accidental cross-firing that happened. And, you know, for example, if you have two stories, in, like Spiderhead and Chivalric Fiasco, if you separate them enough, they cross-fire a little nicely. And so those kind of things that I can't quite articulate, but it's just two or three days of moving stuff around and trying to get – I always thought that, you know, the individual stories tell a story, but then if you arrange the pieces right, it tells a kind of overstory that's a little bigger than you could have imagined in the first place but isn't random.
In reading your work, people always talk about the humor that you have in your stories and that you're a funny guy. And I don't know if it's because I'm a bit dim or my humor responses are limited, but when I've always read you, I've always become incredibly sad.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, it's not an unworthy emotion to have, but to see past the flashes of humor on the top and to see just kind of the bleakness of...
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I love that Flannery O'Connor quote about, you know, you can choose what you write, but you can't choose what you make live. And I don't really understand why the stories tend to skew so dark. I don't really feel that way. Well, I don't think I feel that way in life generally, but I think, you know, you sort of have to... I had those 6 or 7 really fallow years after Syracuse, and that was a really good lesson in the fact that you don't really get to choose your register. You know, you have to do what works and what's energetic, and that is psychologically complicated. I don't know why that should be the case. And I guess the way I think of it is sort of like, you know, that Portuguese fado music or the blues where the basic offset is this is being written on a bad day. You know, the things that I'm describing are sad things. And then as balance, you get the joy that's in the production. So a fado singer who's really on is just, I mean, so full of life that you can't help but feel it as a positive valence, you know. So in making this kind of scale model of the world, it might be that the events are sad and dark, you know, exaggeratedly so. And then what's working on the other side is maybe the humor or the voice or maybe just the joy of the execution, you know. So I'm not sure I really have an answer for that. But I know if I say, oh, this time let's make a bunch of happy stories, then that it won't cohere into anything. So I think a lot about the fact that we kind of assume that a book of stories, say, or a novel, is a linear representation of the writer's feelings about things. And I don't think that's actually the case. I think it's a machine that you make. Maybe the idea would be that there'd be some rough linear resemblance to life as you've lived it, but I think not so. It's a little more of a funhouse mirror. So I think you're really, it's just a little machine and you're trying to get it to stand up and walk. And maybe the relation to real life is kind of nebulous. But, you know, if you could get the reader to feel slightly energized, maybe more alive or something, then that's good. And it doesn't really matter. Like Flannery O'Connor, you know, I see very little resemblance between her stories and any real life I've ever lived. But you read those stories and you come out and you can really see things again. You know, you can see the traits that she writ large, you know, you can see them more acutely in life, and that's a desirable thing. So I think that the whole idea of what a story is open. I think if you're really working in that form, you don't know, and you kind of would rather not know, in the hope that each new example is kicking the door open a little further.
Have you ever noticed any pattern on people and how they react to your stories?
All good people actually tend to like them. No, I know. I mean, you get different. Some people say, "Oh, they're so hopeful and they're so compassionate and kind." And other people say, "You must really be mad." And you know, so I don't really notice a pattern. I guess really, you know, the thing you would want at the end of the day is for them to be considerable. So maybe somebody really hates it or really likes it or just really confused by it. I feel like that's preferable to someone who goes, yeah, I read your story. Mm-hmm. You know, that would be almost like the worst case. And if somebody gets off or confused, that would be much better than having it just be kind of a flatline experience.
You talked about the working class aspect mm-hmm. of your life, and we talked about the financial success a little bit earlier, the relative mm-hmm. success. But what is it like getting praise?
Pretty good. You know, no, it is good. I guess it's kind of like anything else. If you're watching it closely, it's pretty interesting to see the way that your mind reacts to it, you know. And I think the closest analogy would be eating beans. You know, if you eat beans, you are going to and it's not really, it's nothing against you personally, you know, but your body is going to react to that a certain way. And so I think when you get praised, you do is you tend to make the mistake I talked about earlier, where all your life you've been being convinced that you're not that important, you're not that permanent, and you're not that interesting. And then when you get praise, your stupid ego starts going, wait a minute, we were wrong. You know, you really are important. So it's nice. And I think the main thing is just to say, well, okay, that's good. That's kind of temporary, and it's kind of like a cloud of smoke. If we can take any of it and use it to make the next thing better, then that's the only real valid use for it, you know. But actually, it's the same about being criticized. If you know, you get a lot of negative reviews, it's kind of the same thing. It's a cloud of smoke that's going to pass away. If it affects you in a way that screws you up or makes you live worse or write worse, then that would be a mistake.
I don't know if you've seen it yet, but yesterday on Gawker.com, mm-hmm. a writer was kind of insulting you, but it was really a begging plea mm-hmm. for you to write a novel.
Mm-hmm. All right. You know, I mean, I think, I mean, at this age, at this stage, I kind of know, you know, my process, and I'm not against it, but I also wouldn't do it just to do it. I mean, for me, the whole thing is always you start something, and it, you know, Stuart Dybeck has said, you know, a story is always talking to you, and if you have to listen to it. So you start something, and if it says, I really want to be 15 pages, why do you keep making me 30? Then, you know, at this stage of my career, the art is in saying, okay, you're 17 pages. And if something, you know, it's never happened to me yet, but if something said, I really want to be 300, then I'd be an idiot not to respect it. But so I think it's kind of in a way, it's private, you know, I'm going to, you know, do what is best. You know, and then,
but you know, do you get a rush from writing first lines?
No, not really. Not so much. I get a rush out of writing last lines. That's pretty good. You know, one of the things that I figured out early was if you think of a line as a first line, you're going to block up. But if you just think of this, a bunch of prose, and I'm pretty comfortable revising. So in time, this will straighten itself out and a first line will present itself. But all these things are kind of just means of tricking yourself into being more productive. So if I think about a first line, oh, today I got to write a first line, then that's a wasted day. But if you say, well, you know, I'll just kind of squirt out four pages that I know are not going to be that great, but I also know I have the taste to come back and fix them, then that's a little more friendly of a work atmosphere.
What would something that George Saunders like that would surprise people be unusual?
What do I like? I like the band The Distillers. I don't know if that's surprising. I don't know.
Is that Brody Dahl?
I don't know. It's just like a real thrashy kind of
punk.
Yeah.
Australia.
Yeah. No, I don't know. I don't think. I'm guessing people don't have a whole lot of
conceptions.
Yeah, I hope they don't spend a lot of time, you know. Just put a little recording studio in my basement on like an iMac, and that's kind of fun. But maybe they'd be surprised that every single song I've ever written is sucky, you know, completely worthless.
Now, is that musically or lyrically wise?
Both, actually. Yeah, I try to be consistent. when I was younger, I thought I might be a musician. And I, with time and again, get to the point where I can play pretty well, but I don't have strong opinions about a song. I can write it and go, no. And same with novels, actually. So far, if I write something kind of long, I don't mind it, but I don't have a strong, you know, like a kind of savage impulse. But with short stuff, I have a real, I can write 8 pages and suddenly know what to do, you know, have a strong opinion. So at Syracuse, I tell my students that really is not a trivial thing, is to get yourself into a mode of production about which you have a really strong opinion. Because at least then, you know, you can take your chances and, you know, but if your feelings about something are murky, then it's really a hell realm, because you have no way to guide yourself in or out of the forest. So music is like that. I like to do it, but when it's done, I don't have any strong feelings about one or the other.
Does teaching fiction make stupid interviews like this easier?
No, that's not a stupid interview. No, and I love teaching, and we have, you know, it's kind of the best case there, because we get this year, the admissions things are waiting for me at home, but we got 560 40-page packets for 6 spots. So the people that we get are just off the charts. So it's really not, it's just a pleasure. It's not hard. And it, you know, there's a certain amount of, you know, having to prepare and to reread stuff and kind of, you know, work with it a little more analytically, that I think is actually kind of good. It sort of permeates in a little bit. And I teach mostly a workshop, and then I teach the Russian short story, which, so every year I get to go back and read those classics again. So it's all great.
I just been in the sense of constantly talking about the craft and being.
Yeah,
able
no,
to.
I like it. I think it's one of those things where, as long as you don't mistake the talking about it for the doing it, it's like a critical moment when you change hats and you go, it's good to talk critically and it's good to discuss and theorize. And then at some point, you have to remember that if that stuff follows you into the writing room, it might cause a bit of a problem. You know, so just real. I will come home on Thursday afternoon, having had a great couple of days of talking about writing, and then on the way home, I just kind of go, okay, now that was fun. This is different, and kind of put on that second hat.
Anything you're working on right now?
Yeah, I've actually got one thing in the hole at home that I'm hoping to get back to, but, you know, it's just some pages with problems.
Well, George, thanks so much for spending a few minutes with me.
Really a pleasure. Thanks.
George Saunders is the author of 10th of December Stories, which is available from Random House. I'm Stephen Usfree for Chapter 16.org and Humanities Tennessee. Thanks so much for listening.